Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Truth and Movies. Today, we have a different kind of origin story in the before he was infamous high school drama, My Friend Dahmer.
And as part of the Dahmer fan club, I appoint myself the Minister of Propaganda.
Then we're off to France to attempt to solve the cinematic puzzle that is Arnaud Desplechin's mysterious Ishmael's ghosts. And then Film Club and its killer clowns from outer space in Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Why here? Why now? Why clowns?
It's all coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. It's Michael Eder here again, sitting across from David Jenkins, head honcho at Little White Lies. David, welcome back.
Hey.
And Elena Lazic.
Hello.
Hi, Elena. I'm ticking off the bingo card of Little White Lies podcast guests here.
Yeah, this is
great
first
to
time.
Finally be on together.
Yeah.
This is the top trump, surely.
Is it really? I mean, maybe some of our listeners can send in with their top trumps.
Oh, my God.
Ranking Little White Lies podcast.
What would the categories be, I wonder?
I don't think this is...
We shouldn't even get into this.
It's too stressful for me. Come on.
But speaking of listeners, we have had one bit of feedback from the last couple of weeks from Lewis Allen saying, "Hi, team. I knew you're busy in Cannes, but could I get your thoughts / review on Deadpool 2? I think, unfortunately, since all three of us were in Cannes, none of us have had a chance to see Deadpool 2 yet."
Yes, not got around to it.
Hey,
that's right.
I'm fully intending on seeing it this weekend if
yes,
I can.
Next long-haul flight, we'll lock that down for
yeah.
you.
Yeah. However, Hannah Woodhead did review for Little White Lies. That should be on the website,
yep.
lwlies.com. You can see what she made of the film there, and maybe we can feedback down the line if we ever get around to seeing it.
Indeed.
But now we need to talk about Jeff, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
This is My Friend Dahmer, adapted from the graphic novel that follows the pivotal final high school years in the life of serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer, during which he became something of a mascot, muse, and local celebrity for a group of smart-aleck fellow students who set up a Jeffrey Dahmer fan club.
Dahmer, where have you been? I think we should form a Dahmer fan club.
What?
Yeah, there's only so much time left. I think with you as our fearless leader, we can really disrupt this school. Go out in style. Yeah, and infamy.
Yeah, and if we don't, I'm gonna have to do something crazy. Like kill the Pope.
Dahmer, look, I already drew you, actually. This one's called Dahmer and a Bag of Groceries. What do you think? And as part of the Dahmer fan club, I appoint myself the Minister of Propaganda.
So that's My Friend Dahmer. Elena, you reviewed this for the magazine, and you spoke about it quite highly.
Mm.
What do you think sets this one apart from the usual sort of serial killer film fare?
What really, really impressed me is that, obviously, this is like a sort of origin story. So the thing that sells it is like, oh, why did he become a serial killer? What happened to this man to become this monster, you know? And the film, like, is based on trying to answer those questions, but obviously, if these questions were answerable, there would be no serial killers. Like, we would have found out a way to stop them. And so that's why it's just incredible the way the film is like a balancing act between nature and nurture, because there's a dimension of Jeffrey Dahmer that he's just like born this way, and another where really like unpleasant things happen to him, and this and it's like you can't pinpoint one of the reasons as a reason why he became a serial killer. But obviously the film is based on the graphic novel by one of those friends that's in the film, who treated Dahmer in not an amazing way. Kind of, it's not bullying, but it's kind of like a similar kind of like mistreatment and like just making him like demeaning him.
It's that sort of that strange, maybe it's a particularly you know, masculine trait around that age where you have these boys who are too smart for their own good, and they think that it's disrupting the school by doing some crazy, weird, messed up stuff. So they get this guy who has, you know, he what is it that he's doing? He's sort of, it's
like simulates like palsy.
Palsy. Yeah. He has these
fake fits. Spazzing.
Spazzing in the sort of 1978 term, very out of date term. But sort of having these fits in public in school and then later at a shopping mall. And to them, it's hilarious and so cool and different. But what they're doing is promoting and further sort of pushing Dahmer down this route towards isolation and away from socialization.
Yeah. It's just really perverse. But I just really think it's amazing to have this guy who did this actually write a comic book about it, I mean, a graphic novel, and then make it into a film that doesn't either excuse him nor, you know, expunge him of all responsibility. Like, it's just such a tortured, like, story. And when you watch it, it's just, you first it starts, the film starts with all these really amusing references to the stuff that we are told that serial killers do, like, oh, he's torture animals, and all like dialogue that in retrospect, when you know that he's going to be a serial killer, is just really funny. And I think it's all done in purpose, because it's like, oh god, this is like a bad because serial killer, and you get all those little things that you know are going to lead to someone being a serial killer. But then it stops being funny because, like, it's not just that, and it's actually he was a real person, and you really you get out of the myth thing and more into like this was a person that no one really understood ever and no one will ever understand, and because it's impossible to understand those instincts, and it's just, it gets really, really moving and really scary. Like, I was just terrified by the end of the film, because I read a lot about serial killers to the point where I'm not scared reading about them anymore. Like, I'm reading this book about Ted Bundy at the moment.
Right.
That's really fascinating. And I've lost this, like, kind of primal fear of serial killers, which the first time I did read about them, I was, like, terrified. And by the end of this film, it was fully restored to the degree that I was, like, almost, I was feeling sick in the cinema. And it was, I mean, what else do you want from a serial killer movie, you know?
Exactly. David, how did you go with this one?
That's interesting. I think I had a slightly different reaction. I thought it was a pretty impressive film, but like, I didn't really get on with the idea of like this idea of retroactively looking at the man he became and trying to sort of answer some of the questions that we might have about how that character was born. It does, like, this idea of like ticking off this kind of list of things, like, he did this, so this would have led to this. And he did that, so it would have led to that. And, like, you know, foregrounding this idea that he was, you know, there's a sequence where, I think it's a pretty kind of silly sequence, actually, where they go fishing.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, we're only going fishing if we throw the fish back in the lake.
Yeah.
And then as soon as they catch a fish, they're like, okay, Dahmer, chop the fish off the line and throw him back humanely. All that he does is grabs a knife and just stabs the fish.
That's the one sequence in the film I didn't like, because from everything I've read, that's not how he would do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he, in the film, is presented as like an impulse he can't control. Yeah. And that's not how it works. Like, it's impulses that we can control. And Jeffrey Dahmer was notorious for getting drunk before his killings because he couldn't kill when he was sober. Right. So this is clearly like not...
And he would strangle his victim. He would basically... Yeah, strangle his victims in a kind of more discreet fashion before he would do the really awful stuff.
Yeah, he was like kind of a bit of a coward in that way. And so that one sequence actually is the one thing I didn't like about the film.
I think the framing, though, is quite interesting, and this idea of John Backdurf, who is... I mean, maybe you'll be able to confirm this, but he's quite a kind of famous comic book artist.
In his own way, he's had a few graphic novels that have been very well regarded, but this one did put him on the map internationally. Mm.
It's kind of looking at this idea of, you know, he's asking whether he was instrumental in actually almost like fast-tracking this serial killer to the place that he ended up. And I don't know. There was bits of it where I feel that he's almost trying to say that, yeah, my friend Dharma, I'm the guy behind Dharma. If it wasn't for me, he wouldn't be this famous folk legend, like, you know, this sort of horrible, horrible person that we all know for these reasons. And that, you know, he does it in a way that's not ever, you know, he's not apologetic. I almost feel that I wanted the film to be more about him than Dharma.
Yeah.
Because Dharma, we know, you know, like, I mean, although Dharma is the obvious interesting character, the idea of having this guy, this person we know in the orbit that we can almost project onto, and like you can see him built, you know, his interaction with him more. I don't know. I thought Durf was more of a kind of secondary character in the film.
I think nearly all my problems with the film are problems of adaptation. The book, which I would strongly recommend reading, has a whole extra level to it of this sort of troubling memoir from the point of view of in 1991 when the crimes came to light.
Wow.
Years later, Durf and his friends are like, you know, he gets a phone call from his wife who's working at the local paper and says, you went to school with this guy who's killed 17 guys. And Dharma wasn't even his first impulse as to who that was out of the weirdos in his year.
Oh.
So he then had to go through this whole thing of, who was Dharma? Oh, God, I remember this fan club, and goes and talks to his friends. And that's the sort of frame for this, for the book, which you lose in the film. And so some of those searching, questioning, you know, instincts in the film of whose fault was it? Did this lead to it? Is it because of a broken home? Is it because of a sort of latchkey kid generation where no one was looking after the kids? Was it drugs, mental health, alcoholism? All of that just seems to be presented quite kind of straightforwardly in the film, whereas in the book it really is just trying to search for answers through memory. And then also the film plays so much with irony all the way through, as you say, Elena, with, you know, did this lead to this, or did we almost miss out on... There are certain sequences towards the end where I think it's pushed to a dubious level, where it's the shadow of what he will become in these contexts. But that's not there in the book. And it's also, in that adaptation, they adopt a different genre, which is sort of freaks and geeks, Judd Apatow, 1970s high school comedy, in a way, which doesn't play out so well for me.
I tell you what, one element I did like, actually, that you just brought up. One thing that I'm very negative on in movies in general is when you have like bullies and that they're very sort of self-consciously bullying characters, and they're shown in sort of very black and white shades as the evil characters, the dark characters, the people who are kind of causing another character pain and suffering. Whereas I think what this film does is it's a very uniquely credible version of what bullying means and how it's really insidious. And the people who are doing it often don't know they're doing it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can even double as, like, you know, what they think is friendship, you know? And just that idea of, like, Dharma himself maybe not even knowing whether he's being bullied or not, but kind of sensing it.
Mm.
Like, that he is this figure of fun, and that although he's in their group and, you know, he's their mascot in a way, there's always a sense throughout the film that he's kind of like, I know what's happening here. But it is...
And the bullies themselves too at some point.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is really tragic. Yeah. But to go back to your thing about how it should focus more on Backdurf, I think we have to mention that Alex Wolff as John Backdurf, so Durf, is just incredible to me. I'm obsessed with this guy. I think he's incredible. Mm-hmm. I just saw him in Hereditary as well, which is amazing. And I think he really brings so much of what you say is missing in the film, which is more... places more in line with this character. I think the way that we don't, because he's so amazing, but I think the way that we don't see much more of him than just, oh, he's this guy and he's kind of like, he can draw and he's kind of like the leader of his gang and he's fun and he's a very charismatic guy. I think it's just like, because he's played by Alex Wolff as well, and because he's just really well written in my sense, it's like we don't need to know more of him because he's just normal kid. And like, I feel like we get so much of what he's like just from this performance and from the few lines we get from him, a few insights. I just feel like it's like we don't need to talk more about him. Like, I feel there's so much already of him in the film. And the way, and I don't agree with you that the film is like not apologizing, because when you've got those sequences where Dharma is doing the, you know, doing a Dharma, where he's like simulating, like, what do you say?
Spazzing out.
Spazzing out, whatever. there's a moment where it gets really uncomfortable, and I couldn't believe that this was in the film. Mm. That there are these sequences where he's doing that in public, and it's just so uncomfortable to watch, but also everyone in the film is really uncomfortable, and it's just a horrible thing to witness, and it's so depressing and sad and so dark. And I think in that sense, the film is really putting some sort of blame on the Bagdov character and on all those kids who let that happen and used him. And then once it got too annoying, they just dropped him and never even apologized. So, yeah, I don't think that he gets off the hook completely.
It's a good performance, and also it feels this film is quite shrewdly cast. Mm. Both Alex Wolff and Ross Lynch, who plays Jeffrey Dahmer, are both former Disney stars or yeah. Nickelodeon stars.
Yeah.
And this is sort of their sort of adult movies. And just looking at the film's reception in the States in particular, you have a lot of fans out there who yeah. followed them from their TV years. And they're going to go and watch this film. Mm. And I wonder how that's going to play yeah. out for them. Is this the hashtag relatable Jeffrey Dahmer movie?
Yeah. I looked up my friend Dahmer hashtag on Twitter like a few months ago, and there were all those teenager girls being like, oh my God, it was so scary.
Because Ross Lynch is sort of a good-looking Jeffrey yeah, Dahmer, yeah. really.
Well, yeah, I guess so, yeah. But like, they really made him like miserable.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's quite a good limited performance that he yeah. gives as well. What do you think about that, Amy?
Oh, no, I think that he's very kind of... I mean, there's almost a kind of shades of Napoleon Dynamite in there.
Wow, yeah. Like what, I haven't seen that.
That it's kind of... That there is something kind of... Like just an emotion chip that's missing there. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like... Although on one side you've got like these, you know, scenes of family strife and issues at school and his kind of obsessions with certain people, mm. he never shows any, you know, he has this kind of mm. blank-faced attitude to everything.
Yeah, he's been numb for a long yeah. time. Mm-hmm. But I really liked how at the very end you got this incredible scene with Alex Wolff in the car. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to spoil
it. Let's not spoil
it. I'm not going to spoil it, but there's a scene, and you really realise that, okay, Jeffrey Dahmer has problems, but like everyone has problems and no one uses them as excuses to kill people. And it gets my blood just went cold. It was amazing.
So should we throw some scores at this? Elena, what do you think about this film?
Oh, probably like 3, because I was kind of scared. And mm-hmm. the look of it is so, it looks good. You know, it's mm-hmm. a very polished like teen movie. So I was a bit terrified of that. And also just the whole concept of having this guy write about this. I was a bit like suspicious. But then probably 5. Like, I'm going to rewatch it like so many times.
David?
I'd probably say, yeah, similar 3. It looked like a kind of solid American indie film mm. that covered ground, you know, comic mm-hmm. book links as well. It was, you know, didn't really sort of float my boat in that sense. Mm-hmm. And then probably like, I would say like high 3s
right.
across the board. It didn't quite kind of reach a level that, you know, really got me. But I thought it was a kind of interesting little film.
Yeah, I'd probably say I had read the book beforehand, so I was really intrigued mm. about how they would do it. So quite a 4 in anticipation. But then these little issues I had knock it down to maybe high 3s, as you said, David. But rewatching it as I did over the weekend, they still bugged me. So I'd recommend reading the book instead.
I'll read it soon then.
Please do. Mm-hmm. So that was My Friend Dahmer. Up next, Ishmael's Ghosts. So Ishmael's Ghosts, following a filmmaker whose life is sent into a tailspin by the reappearance of his wife, Marion Cotillard, 20 years after she disappeared. The Little White Lies review said, where most contemporary films could stand to lose an hour, this latest could use an extra one. Davey, is that true?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that that's been said, because when the film originally screened in Cannes in 2017, it was screened in a truncated version where I think he had 20-30 minutes cut out of it already. So I actually interviewed him there, and he talked about that, and he said that, you know, he had a longer version, but it was completely down to the producers which version gets seen in what place. And I think he wanted this longer version to be seen. I mean, I guess it is, in the sense that, as with all of Desplechin's films, for those who've seen them, they're very rich, and they're very kind of, he focuses on dialogue and conversation, and sometimes where the story is going doesn't fall into the background, but kind of like almost sort of meshes into the whole kind of texture of the film. Mm. So sometimes you're watching these films, and certainly the ones that are more kind of plot driven are some occasionally a little difficult to follow. I mean, I think he made his name with these very sort of talky family sagas, right, like Kings and Queen and
A Christmas Tale.
And he released an amazing film last year called My Golden Days, which was kind of autobiographical film. And yeah, this one is with Matthew Almeric, who is one of his kind of, you could call it his muse, his alter ego.
His sixth collaboration.
And in this one, it feels like the most kind of direct crossover because he plays a filmmaker, and the story is that he is sort of having trouble making this kind of quite bizarre sort of John le Carré style mystery detective thing, like political sort of undercover spy thing.
About his brother.
And the making of the film kind of goes to pot when his old lover who left him, played by Marion Cotillard, just sort of like literally walks back into his life while he's on holiday with his current wife, who's played by Charlotte Gainsbourg. And then the sort of second half of the film is him kind of, his brain exploding almost, where he goes back to his family home. In fact, maybe you could tell, like, all of Desplechin's films either take place in or reference or involve a visit to this place called Roubaix.
I'm not sure where that is. I think it's outside Paris.
I think it is, yeah. It's like northern sort of suburb of Paris.
Yeah.
Is there anything like...
I don't know.
I think it's his like childhood.
That's probably where he comes from. That wouldn't surprise me because it's quite. I think it's quite like a not bourgeois but like residential area where people have houses there. So yeah.
So he goes back to this big old house. You know, starts to do all these crazy things involving guns and having big arguments with the producers. and I mean, although that's the kind of gist of the plot. It's actually, I think the sort of beauty of the film is all about the kind of the dialogue, the exchanges, the acting. It's quite a kind of strange film. It's, I think he's referencing Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo in that it's got kind of the idea of doubles and the idea of not being able to sort of let go of the past and, you know, obsessions being brought back to life through images and things like that. But it's almost a kind of, I would say, like, lightly experimental riff on that idea.
Well, even laying out the plot as you did, we're almost making it seem like a more conventional film than it is, because even in the first half hour, you've had this jumbled up mix of perspectives of films within films. You start with the film within the film, and then there's Charlotte Gainsbourg as his modern day lover, telling almost first person recollection of how they met. And it's very puzzling as you go through. There's a scene later in the film where he's planning out the convoluted plot for his thriller, and it's all connections within connections in the attic of his house. And that's kind of what we had to do, right, to figure out what this film is all about. Mm. Elena, did you enjoy this as a puzzle?
I think I enjoyed it. Yeah, I don't think I understood everything, but I was weirdly moved by some aspects of it, especially the Charlotte Gainsbourg character, because she plays his current girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And then she's confronted by this woman who didn't just leave him, but she just disappeared overnight and no one knew where she was. Even her dad didn't know. Mm-hmm. And everyone's
ghosted.
And no one knew where she was or if she was alive or anything. And so when there's this thing where this woman comes back and obviously he's got really strong feelings for her still, even though she was gone for 20 years, it's just very moving because she's also this character who... there's this scene where she talks about herself and her life, and she's like this woman who was always dating guys who either were married or didn't want to commit, and then they would leave her, and then she finds herself in her 40s and she doesn't have children, and she's not unhappy, but she's in this situation now that maybe is not what she thought she would be. And even though she's kind of like not the main character, she brings some really like moving things inside this rather silly and weird story that were really moving. But I think that's what he does in most of his films. It's like the whole construction is a bit weird and kind of doesn't make sense and just barely hangs together. But then within that structure, you've got really moving details that are really beautiful.
Those details didn't rise up for me, probably because of this very intellectualized upper layer. So many references, Lacan, James Joyce, Bob Dylan, Philip Roth, Where did you fall on that, Davey?
I mean, I just
did it move you?
I just love that. I mean, because I think it's a real sort of personal imprint on the film. You meet Desplechin, and he is just like as passionate about these things in real life and about exploring these ideas. I mean, like, and he's got this, he sort of draws from this really diverse palette of references as well. Like, I remember chatting to him, and one minute he's talking about how much he doesn't like Henry James, and then he's going on about how important hip hop is and how much he loves Kendrick Lamar. So, I mean, he's like really kind of plugged into all these different things. And I think he's just this super passionate guy who's really into like art, culture, seeing what people are doing, how they're expressing themselves. And I think he sort of tries to channel all of that into his movies. And I think that you're almost not meant to understand what is being said, mm-hmm. but just like this idea that he is kind of creating these characters as a sort of almost like as versions of himself, as like pieces of himself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But just going back to a point you said, I think this is, yeah, this is definitely, I mean, the one thing that he manages to do for me, which I think is probably going to be different for most people, is that although he, Desplechin, has these very kind of heightened and almost like, as I say, like expressionist films that seem slightly above reality in their kind of manicness and their kind of having these people talking about these very kind of talking about things in this very kind of literate way, he manages to make things really moving just mm-hmm. very suddenly. Mm-hmm. Like he can just turn things down or turn things up very quickly, and I think in that sense he's got an amazing, masterful hand as a director. And I think in this film, where as moving as it is to see like the Marion Cotillard character sort of explaining the lost time that she's had in her life and trying to explain herself. Conversely, you have Charlotte Gainsbourg, who I think is incredible in this mm-hmm. film as the woman who thinks she you know, she's on this kind of bright path, then suddenly it all kind of falls away. Mm. And the way that she sort of like dissolves into the background and the choices she takes are just like, I think, like the most interesting thing about the
yeah,
film almost.
I agree. Yeah, I think like watching his films is like being crushed by a giant wave. You don't really understand what's happening, but then some things stick when it draws back. Mm-hmm. And
it's exhilarating.
Yeah,
I think.
You just kind of have to sit and like just do the best you can. And mm-hmm. some things will stick. And I think that's how you're supposed to watch them.
Yeah, and that's why I think that Mathieu Amalric is such a perfect collaborator for him, because he's such a ticky, nervous energy sort of performer. Yeah. But then can suddenly turn and deliver a little moment of poignancy. Yeah. He's a character, but also be very big at other points as well. Mm. And this is quite a good role for that.
Yeah, and he's like hypnotizing, so he's kind of like this through line throughout this weird mess. You can follow him and mm-hmm. kind of hold on to him.
Yeah, I found it interesting. The Little White Lies review sort of posits that he may never make another great movie because he's so scattershot as a filmmaker. Do you agree with that, Davey?
Oh, I'm not sure I do. I mean, I think it's amazing that he's allowed to keep doing these movies that he does, these really idiosyncratic, personal, almost like folly type movies. And I hope he is able to continue doing them. And I think it's like a testament to how great, maybe this is a conversation for another time, but like the fact that in France, this is the norm, you know, like that people are allowed to do this. Whereas like, you know, I feel that in other places, maybe even the UK, this kind of thing would probably be like frowned upon, and you know, there would need to be like the commercial marketing hook there for this a film like this to work. Mm. And I guess that I think this idea of a filmmaker who is able to make interesting personal statements, and then because of that, being able to attract big stars like Marion Cotillard and Charlotte Gainsbourg is a great thing. Like people who want to work with this guy. And I think the same with like a filmmaker like Claire Denis, like you know, people like Juliette Binoche and Robert Pattinson like want to work with her because she is like a great, interesting director.
Mm. But that's really interesting what you said, because when I interviewed Arnaud Desplechin and Mathieu Amalric was there as well, someone asked, "Are you going to make another film with Mathieu?" And he was like, "Well, my next film is set in North Africa. It's all a black cast, so Mathieu won't be in it."
Oh, right.
So that sounds like an amazing departure.
Yeah,
he does do these departures. I mean, he made a film called Jimmy P, which didn't come out in the UK, and it was in Cannes, and it got quite a frosty reception. And it was this very, very weird film with with Benicio del Toro playing this Native American, and Amalric in English doing a kind of psychoanalysis of him. And it was this really bizarre, not good film at all. So, like, I'm slightly nervous when he goes off piste because I like the Desplechin film that he does all the time so much. So
I'm sure he'll make more of those.
Yeah.
I'm not worried.
We'll have to see. But for Ishmael's Ghosts, shall we do some scores, David?
Yeah, I would probably say I loved it. It's not my probably not my favourite of his. It's so kind of scattershot. It's a little too scattershot maybe, but like I think it's just got a lot of amazing stuff in it. So probably like fours across the board for me.
Okay.
For me, probably like high threes and maybe a four in at the experience in retrospect. I don't know because it's kind of hard to remember all that's in this film.
Exactly,
like there's just so much to deal with. So yeah, like four, three or something like that.
Yeah, I'd say threes across the board for me. It's still a lot to figure out and process about this film, but I'm not sure whether I want to go back anytime soon. But that was Ishmael's Ghosts. Next is Film Club.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and we have a great trailer to listen to.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened. You see that? Something different.
It's no shooting star.
Why here? Why now? Why clowns?
So that's Killer Clowns from Outer Space, celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Something of a video shop classic, maybe. Would you agree, David?
It is definitely one of those films that I remember in my youth, seeing the VHS box on the shelf. And I think it was one of those films that, because you know in the video shop it was always by genre, so you'd have comedy and horror. And I distinctly remember in my local shop, Video City, it would sometimes be in comedy and sometimes be in horror, which feels
appropriate
for the film.
Because it's a monster movie, definitely, but it's definitely a comedy monster movie. It's not got many scares in it, would you say?
It's not a scary film, but I don't think there is an even scintilla of it that wants to be scary. So. Yeah.
Were the listeners scared?
Well, yeah, so we got a couple of comments here. I watched Killer Clowns from Outer Space with a few friends, really enjoyed, quote, bad movies, and thought this one was a classic of the genre. I personally wasn't so keen and probably wouldn't have watched the whole thing if I'd watched it on my own. It was entertaining watching their reaction and comments to the movie more than the movie itself. Maybe. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. And our friend, the futurist, says, Killer Clowns from Outer Space features great set design in a rather boring rip on 50s sci-fi drive-in movies. Highlight is the late 80s and early 90s sweaters, stonewashed jeans with big white sneakers worn by Grant Kramer. I concur with that.
At Lon Concord on Twitter said, thought this would be awful, but it's actually quite inventive and enjoyable. Good choice. And Finley Kribolder said, speaking as someone with phobia of clowns, the general absurdity and campy nature of it made me forget said phobia, making it a much more enjoyable watch as far as clown films go. Pretty positive.
That's a genre for the video shop, clown films.
Yeah, the clowns genre.
But it is such an inventive film. This is the strange Kyoto brothers, three of them, who made this. They were the special effects guys behind Critters, I believe. At least they designed those monsters and then were given relative carte blanche to follow their muse on this one.
That's another subgenre as well. It's when special effects guys make movies.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, if any listeners know of any good ones.
Oh, let us know.
Or stuntmen who make movies as well. Stunt coordinators making movies. That's a whole world of pain.
The cogs are already whirring.
Yes.
But this is notably their only film.
Yes.
To date. Do you think they should have made another one after this?
Well, I mean, I watched it a couple of months ago as a sort of... When I find a random film on Netflix, I basically order it by time. So, like, the oldest films first. And I always want to look at what the old films are. And Killer Clowns from Outer Space was one of those ones where I'd watched all the old films and that was the last one on the pile. And I was like, what the hey?
Yeah.
And yeah, I was really, I watched it with my wife and she also was really impressed by it. It was like, you know, it is this kind of schlocky, stupid, like really kind of purposefully, epically stupid.
Very
idea,
dorky, yeah.
but made with the kind of care and love and precision of like Kubrick. I mean, it's like, that is the kind of insane core of this film, that it is like this care that has gone into the design of every single different clown to give it its own kind of distinct personality and visual look and size and style. The set, which is like, so the clowns, you'll be surprised to hear, they circumnavigate the galaxy in a flying big top, which lands on Earth in this sort of sleepy town, and plonks down in a kind of like wasteland, and at this kind of point where all these like teenagers are necking, and they go to explore, and obviously they kind of look inside and see that kind of weird things are happening. But by this point, the clowns are already running rampage through the town, and prior to their arrival there's this kind of sequence where you're introduced to all the different members of the, like, single trait members of the town, and you know, you basically watch them all be killed one by one.
It's really not a film that lives or dies by its dialogue or its performances, I'd say, but the design is really something.
It really is. And you could do a proper art exhibition.
Oh yeah,
on Killer Clowns. Like some of the act props.
There's one prop in particular which is only in one shot. I think it's when the lovers are chased by a clown with a gun that shoots popcorn.
Yes,
cost $7,000 to make. It was a working gun. It's
like... terrible. And the popcorn is a kind of like homing device for them for some reason. I don't know why. So what they've done is that, like, clearly in the making of this film, they've sat down, the Chiodo brothers, and written a big, like, what do you call it? A kind of bubble graph.
Like a spider diagram.
Yeah, like a spider diagram. And they put clowns in the middle. And they've just put everything they could think of associated to clowns. Yeah. Like every single thing. Like funny walk, whistles, water spraying, flowers.
Small cars.
And they've just, like, let's take every single clown trait and then flip it into some kind of murder device. And that's basically what the film is in its entirety.
That's brilliant.
And then you've got these two guys who drive around in an ice cream van,
two brothers who are the sort of the town buttheads.
Yeah. Buttheads is the exact right description for them.
Eleni, you didn't get a chance to watch this. Has this convinced you either way?
Oh, yeah, I really want to see it now. The thing you said about every clown device being turned into a murder weapon, that's just what you want from a clown film.
This is the thing, it doesn't so much like intrigue and delight, more than it wears you down. Like, you get to the point where they've gone through so many different stupid things that by the fact that they can keep going and fill a film up to feature length, you're almost thinking, wow,
impressed.
That's really impressive. Yeah.
I'd say there are two that are legitimately inspired. There's one which is the shadow puppet sequence and the one which is the ventriloquism sequence.
Yes.
And they're both actually pretty creepy and use interesting, like the shadow puppet uses traditional hand-drawn animation for a little second there.
There are some bits that are, as I say, as a piece of craft, this film is like, you know, ripe to be studied in film school.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
as an example of like the great things you can do with set design, with special effects, with animation, mm-hmm. with matte shots, with just going and doing stuff with a load of garbage that you find in the alleyway. You know, it's like with makeup as well. Yeah, it's all design and no kind of finesse and story and emotion.
We need to get to work on that exhibition, clearly, exactly, to bring it all together. And clearly the craft did impress people. The Chiodo brothers went on to work on...
Contact Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
I'm sure he loves this movie.
Yeah. I'm sure he does, yes.
I mean, they worked on The Simpsons afterwards, and
oh, wow,
they worked on Team America World Police. And interestingly, one of the brothers was an animator on Vincent, Tim Burton's first short, the stop-motion animation one.
Oh, wow.
So clearly they're well-connected in that world, just not as filmmakers, although they've been talking about a three-part trilogy or a TV series for years.
I can imagine that happening, you know.
In this crazy TV world we're in
it's
now.
It's time.
Netflix feels will right. throw them $100 million, yeah. But that was Killer Clowns from Outer Space. David, what can we expect next week in Film Club?
So next week in Film Club, we're going to be in the episode. We're going to be covering
Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom.
Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
and also McQueen.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Film Club, we're actually going to explore the idea of your and my favorite supporting player, Jeff Goldblum.
Oh yeah,
and ask the question: has he actually ever been in any good films? But
Gasp. Whoa,
yes, whoa, I know.
I mean,
but
I don't like Jurassic Park, but come on.
Whoa. it's an open-ended hypothetical, but we're actually going to cover one which is pretty good by all standards. Mm-hmm. The Fly.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
That hopefully is going to open up a discussion into the kind of acting world of Jeff Goldblum.
That sounds fascinating. I think that's a good one. And already bubbling away with ideas of Jeff Goldblum movies to debunk your hypothesis.
Definitely.
Your
I think anyone who, if you're listening to this and you have some ideas about
mm-hmm.
great Jeff Goldblum movies. In fact, one little thing that I will tell you about, which is something I want to see again. I remember seeing a film ages ago called Vibes. Have either of you heard
Vibes?
Of this?
No.
No.
Oh my God. Vibes is Jeff Goldblum, and it's like a buddy movie with Jeff Goldblum and Cyndi Lauper.
Wow.
As like, they've got like telekinetic powers.
Of course.
And they are hired by a group of gangsters to basically uncover a kind of Mayan treasure. So it's them traveling to South America together. And it's absolutely crazy.
Wow.
It's not so bad that it should be so obscure, I think.
Mm. Do you think
if memory serves?
Is it available to watch anywhere?
It probably should be.
Right.
I'm sure I suspect it probably might be on like YouTube or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like a video rip on YouTube.
Yeah. that was another rental from Video City. So
working through your history with Video City there.
Indeed.
Episode by episode. But you can get in touch with us at LWLies on Twitter, and also littlewhitelies, lwlies.com/podcast for any comments there to enlighten Davey with your favourite Jeff Goldblum movies. I suppose just time to say thank you very much, Elena.
Thank you.
Being here today. And David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I've been Michael Leader, and this has always been a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.